This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
That's Sarah.
And that's Morgan.
And this week, we're coming at you with the tale of the Grimes sisters.
An unsolved crime.
Yes, so we'll get to that in a second. But before all of that, what are you binging this week?
So this week, I'm binging a show that I watched a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it just got put on Netflix.
Nice.
And I'm fucking stoked about it. And it's Community.
Yes. And didn't you already do that one?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
I was going to do it last week.
But oh, that's what it was.
So, Community, if you don't know, it's a show about community college. And you have people from all backgrounds and ages going. And they just, like, get into antics. And it's fucking great. Yeah. I love it, honestly. Like, it's written by Dan Harmon, who's a good writer.
He also does Rick and Morty, things like that.
Yes. And it has 6 seasons, and I only watched the first 5.
Right.
So I'm excited to be able to finish it and watch the 6.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it just has an all-star cast.
Yeah, it does.
Like, I'm just going to mention a couple people.
Okay.
Like, it's got...
You're going to read the whole cast list. Reads IMDb.
Good. But it's got Donald Glover in it. It's got Chevy Chase. It's got Ken Jeong. John Oliver's in it. Like, it's got some good people.
It does.
And it was one of my favorite shows when I watched it, and I'm just, like, reliving it. Like,
yeah.
When I started, I sat down for 6 hours and just watched it. But, yeah, Community is my binge this week, and I'm stoked about it.
It's also one of those shows that, like, once you've seen it and you, like, see the start of the episode, you'll remember what happened pretty much. Yes. And, like, you don't have to fully be present to do it. Like, you can fold laundry and do stuff mm-hmm. while you're doing it, you know? It's like The Office.
Yes.
Like, you can still do stuff and watch it, but still laugh while you're doing it.
And something that my boyfriend pointed out
mm-hmm.
is that there are so many current memes, like, very popular memes right now that are from Community.
Yeah.
That he's like, I didn't know what that was from. And I was like, trust me, there's like 3 more you'll notice.
Yeah, you really, until like it happens, you're like, oh, snap.
Yeah.
That's where that's from.
The majority of them are Ken Jeong.
Yeah. He's a hilarious actor all around.
But what is your binge this week?
My binge is a show that I guess I've been sleeping on. And because we've been self-isolating, I have just been watching as much media as possible. And I started watching The Sinner.
And okay.
Let me frickin' tell ya.
That's the Jessica Biel one?
Yes.
Okay.
That is a fantastic show. She's only in the first season because it's like an anthology style show. So each season has a different storyline and has like a different cast.
Okay.
With the exception of the lead detective, who is Harry Ambrose. And he's like a grizzled detective who like toes the line between being a good cop and a bad cop. You know, he has demons that he has to fight while solving crime. But the first season is really freaking good. Jessica Biel is like the lead character, and she randomly like stabs a dude on the beach one day.
Yeah,
and
I
then
just
the
remember.
Story unfolds, and then season 2 is like a cult.
Okay,
so it's very cool.
Yeah, I remember when like the previews or the trailers were coming out for the first season.
Yeah,
but I never watched it. But it was just like Jessica Biel stabbing someone.
Yeah, I honestly had never actually watched the trailer for it. I think like I heard an ad for it, mm-hmm. but that's like The Sinner sounded familiar. But when I clicked on it, I was like, I have literally no idea what this show is.
And what platform is it on?
I watched it on Netflix. Okay. It is like right now they're in their 3rd season and it's airing on live television.
Okay.
But I don't have time for that. So yeah. I'm just going to wait until it's on Netflix. But the first 2 seasons are great. Great times. But let's just get actually before that. How are you doing, Sarah?
You know
checking
what?
In. It's a month into quarantine. How are you doing?
I'm still working from my parents' house.
Yeah.
So I'm working with my mother.
Yeah.
And I've had to have a conversation with her where I'm like, hey, I need you to not scream into the phone next to my ear because there's a whole fucking house. But she has started, like, I have my phone on without headphones and listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
So she has started listening to podcasts.
Oh, that's fun.
But I was listening to My Favorite Murder today.
Yeah.
And she goes, those girls curse a lot. And I was like, you know what, Mom? It's a podcast. They're allowed to. It's
yeah.
their podcast. She goes, well, if I had a podcast, I wouldn't curse. And I said, well, then maybe you shouldn't listen to my podcast.
But also, when your mom is in person, loves cursing.
Oh, she?
She loves it.
Yes, she drops the F-bomb in every sentence. She's
That's
like,
so
people
funny.
Will judge you. And I'm like, no
yeah,
one cares.
We've gotten comments about it. It's fine. Yeah, but, that makes sense.
And then I have a little project that I'm working on.
Yeah.
My boyfriend found a table.
Okay.
And so I'm sanding it down and painting it. I'm still working on sanding it down.
Yeah.
But that's been my little, like, weekend quarantine project, so I don't just sit on my ass.
Yeah. It's really hard to not do that.
Yeah. How was your quarantine time?
You know it's good.
How was your Easter?
I did literally nothing.
Nice.
Which was great, honestly. Loved it. Loved spending Easter that way. Texted my family, happy Easter, love you guys, don't have to see you and eat ham. Fucking hate ham.
I just went to my parents' house for dinner and I was like, I literally see you every day, so yeah. It's nothing special.
But you know, the second week really got to me. I ate everything in my house.
Oh yeah.
Didn't move my body at all. And then last week I was like, I feel like shit, I'm gonna move my body. And I'm going to, like, eat less. I'm still eating a lot more than I usually do, but I'm not just, like, constantly eating. And, you know, I feel better. Feel good. I've been cleaning every day. Honestly, I'm thriving.
Good.
Mental health, down the drain.
Oh, yeah.
But physically,
but you're
thriving.
Doing things that make it appear that you're thriving.
Yeah, but it is actually, like, helping a lot because when I'm working from home, the way my setup is, I have to see all the trash in our apartment if I don't clean it up. And so, like, it makes me want to keep it clean.
Okay.
So, like, as soon as I get off work from 5 to 6, I use that for, like, any cleaning up around the apartment. Then 6 to 7 is my chill time, video games, whatever I want to do. And then I start making dinner. And then that's it.
Nice.
I've, like, made a little routine for myself.
That's good.
It's the only way I'm not going to go crazy.
I feel that.
So, you know, it's good. It's been chilling.
And we hope all of you guys are also finding something to keep you sane.
Yeah, please do, because this is a great time to go insane. And if you're not doing great, that's okay, too, because
they have call-in therapy and online therapy.
They do.
And everything else.
I think there's things like BetterHelp where you can, like, text. I think there's multiple ones like that, but that's the only one I've heard on, like, every podcast ever as an ad. So, yeah, there are ways to do that. I'm doing the same thing because I literally, like, right before all this was about to start, I was like, I'm going to finally call my therapist. And then this started and I'm like, I have to wait until it's over when I could easily call and just set up a phone appointment. But, you know. Better to live life on the edge. I'm just kidding. That's a terrible way to live.
It's okay.
With your mental health.
I was about to get a haircut before all this happened. And now I'm just, like, slowly cutting my hair a little bit at a time.
Yeah. Let's get into this episode. Now I'm just talking to you because I haven't talked to you. But let's get into the Grimes sisters.
All right. So Joseph and Loretta Grimes were the parents to 7 children. They lived in the McKinley Park community in Chicago, Illinois, and Joseph worked as a truck driver. But Joseph and Loretta's marriage ended in 1951, so Loretta took care of the children and worked 7 days a week in order to afford the mortgage, groceries, and she would even give her children an allowance.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Barbara was 15 and her sister Patricia was 12, and they were inseparable growing up. They were also described as attentive students where they went to school at Thomas Kelly and St. Maurice High Schools. The sisters were huge fans of Elvis.
Huge.
Yes.
Emphasis on the huge.
And on December 28th, 1956, Barbara and Patricia went to the Brighton Theater to watch the Elvis film Love Me Tender for the 11th time.
And some sources say that it was their 15th time.
Yeah.
Which, all in all, is just a lot of times.
It is.
They loved that movie.
The only movie I've seen that many times is Mean Girls.
I think the only movie I've seen that many times is The Little Mermaid.
Nice.
Like, honestly.
So, yeah. They really fucking love Elvis.
They do.
On December 28th, the girls left their family home at around 7:30 p.m. and they promised their mother they would be home by midnight at the latest. The theater was about a mile and a half away from the home, and the girls had a total of $2.50 in their possession at the time.
Which, it's the 50s, so
yeah,
they had plenty for like the movies and stuff.
Barbara had been instructed that 50 cents was needed to be kept in a separate zipper of her wallet in case they wanted to watch the second screening of the film.
Which is smart. You gotta divvy out your money so you don't spend it all on popcorn.
Right? And it is unknown how the girls got to the movie that night. It's not known if they walked or took a bus, but these were kind of the only two options that people looked at, considering it was only a mile and a half away.
Yeah, and they had a bus stop like really close to their home too. Mm-hmm. So later, a school friend named Dorothy would tell investigators that she had actually been seated behind the girls at the theater with her own younger sister. And she left at the intermission of the double feature around 9:30, and she saw the sisters getting some popcorn, and they looked to be in good spirits when she left. And she would actually be the last person to see them alive. It is believed that the girls used their bus money to get the popcorn, and they knew that they would have to walk home. Both sisters stayed to watch the second screening, so possibly the 12th time if they had really seen it that many times. So midnight comes, and the girls do not come home. Loretta, their mother, became slightly worried, so she sent out their older sister, Teresa, who is 17, and their brother Joey, 14, to go and wait by the bus stop closest to the family home in case they were just arriving late. They waited for three buses to pass before returning home. And buses don't pass often.
No, it's like once every like 45 minutes or something. Yeah, like that.
I mean, maybe back then more often, but I'm not sure. Loretta also began calling the girls' friends during this time, saying, like, have you seen them? And they had no luck with this. When their siblings returned to the house, Loretta called the police and filed a missing persons report on her daughters at 2:15 a.m. on December 29th.
So a citywide search was almost immediately initiated, and at this time sparked the largest missing persons case in Cook County. In this search, hundreds of police officers assisted. Cook County officers were also assisted by colleagues from surrounding suburbs, and a task force was dedicated to finding the sisters. Hundreds of local volunteers also joined the search that began on December 29th. Police searched door to door through Brighton Park, and numerous canals and rivers in the area were dredged. More than 15,000 flyers were distributed to local houses, and parishioners of the church, all of the girls' church that they went to, also offered a $1,000 reward for information leading to their whereabouts.
Which, if $2.50 gets you and your sister two movies and popcorn,
yeah,
that's a lot of money.
Throughout this investigation, over 300,000 people were questioned.
Yeah.
Out of these, 2,000 of them were subjected to serious interrogation about their potential culpability in the case. Two arrests occurred, and charges were brought against some individuals who confessed to the crime, and it turns out it wasn't true.
Yeah.
One man, Edward Bedwell, says he had been coerced into giving a confession after being subjected to a prolonged interrogation. And we'll hear more about this later.
Yeah, and this happens all the time, too.
Exactly. Although the police put in lots of effort for this case, little hard evidence was found. Several teenagers and the media reported sightings of the girls often, which did not help this case. So one report said that some teens who had been at the theater that night said that they saw the girls conversing and then entering a car that was driven by a young man who looked like Elvis Presley. And the car was described as a Mercury model vehicle.
But before the task force was initiated, several investigators initially believed that this was simply a runaway case, or the girls were voluntarily staying with unknown boyfriends.
Scandal.
12 and 15.
Right.
The parents rejected this idea and pushed the task force to be created. Loretta said that the girls would never run away and would certainly not leave behind the brand new AM radio that they had received for Christmas just days before, or any extra money, as they had only enough to see the two shows. The story became front page news by December 31st in the area, and their disappearance would only become serious a week after the family had received no contact from the girls.
That's too much time.
It's too long, for sure.
Especially for underage girls.
Yeah, because, like, after a day or two, a 12 or 15-year-old girl, at this time especially, is gonna come home. Like,
yeah, they can't survive on their own.
Yeah, anytime I tried to run away when I was, like, a kid, I would be home within, like, an hour.
Yeah,
I thought I was gone for days, and I was, like, gone for 15 minutes. So, extensive media coverage was done, including news reports pleading the girls to come home, because sightings would continue to trickle in as late as February 9th. So people were saying the girls were still alive and they were seeing them. And that wasn't helping the case.
Mm-hmm.
Any of these sightings said one or both of the girls were seen in various places. And all of these sightings just made the investigators think that their theory was correct and the girls just ran away.
So more theories began that the girls had traveled to Nashville, Tennessee to see Presley live in concert.
Which, like, I get it. Yeah. Story checks out. But these just don't seem like the kind of girls who would do that.
Mm-hmm. And others said that they simply left to emulate Presley's lifestyle. The media portrayed the Grimes sisters as delinquents and runaways, which is shitty. And yeah, the media does some more shitty things.
Yeah.
But Loretta publicly pleaded on several occasions, saying, "If someone is holding them, please let the girls call me," as she believed that they had been kidnapped. She even said, "I'll forgive them from the bottom of my heart," just because she wanted her daughters back so badly.
Yeah, like kind of a no questions asked thing. Just bring me back my daughters.
Loretta also received a series of letters in early January 1957 from someone claiming to have the girls. The letter said, "Hello, Loretta Grimes. I am writing to inform you that I'm in possession of your two girls, Barbara and Patricia." The letter gave Loretta instructions to take a train to a church in Milwaukee with $1,000 of ransom money, and she would then see Barbara to hand her the envelope of money. Barbara would take the money out of the church, and then the girls would come in the church together and the family would be able to leave safely.
Feels elaborate.
Yeah. So on January 12th, she traveled to Milwaukee and waited for 3 hours, but nothing happened. The police ended up doing some research and found that it was actually a mental patient who had sent the letters.
That's sad.
Mm-hmm. On, like, someone who was in an institution.
Yeah.
On January 19th, 1957, Elvis Presley's team released a statement saying, "If you are good Presley fans, you'll go home and erase your mother's worries." He also made a direct radio plea to the girls asking them to return home.
So here are some sightings of the girls, because just so many of them happened. Multiple people reported seeing the girls boarding a Chicago Transit Authority bus on Archer Avenue after the screening of the show, including the actual bus driver. A young man named Roger Menard told investigators that he had been sitting behind the girls in the Love Me Tender screening and walked in the same direction as them afterwards. He said that he saw two separate cars approach the girls, but the girls did not get into the cars and kept walking. Two teenage boys driving around reported seeing the girls walking about two blocks from their home at 11:30 p.m., and the girls were giggling and jumping out of doorways at each other. To me, that one sounds like the most likely sighting.
Yeah, like they're just kind of like playing around.
Yeah, like they're on a high from seeing their favorite musician in their favorite fucking movie ever, you know, just being teenage girls. Jack Franklin, a security guard, told investigators that he had given directions to the girls the morning of December 29th, around 12 hours after they left the theater. He said that he remembered them because the girls had been rude to him.
Which is not very like the Grimes sisters.
Yeah, from everything we've heard. On December 29th at around 2:30 p.m., Barbara's friend, Judy Burrow, said that she had seen the sisters walking west on Archer Avenue. Archer Avenue is a popular sighting place for them.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia's classmate, Catherine Barack, claims she... That's probably not how you say that. Oh. Catherine Barack claims she saw Patricia walking past a restaurant she was inside of in the early evening of December 29th, and she said that Patricia was accompanied by two other girls. 6 hours later, a cashier at the Clark Theater in downtown Chicago said she saw both girls at 12:45 a.m. The owner of a restaurant said that he had seen the girls on December 30th at 5:40 a.m. and Patricia had been too sick or drunk to walk without staggering. And then finally, a clerk at the Claremont Hotel, not finally, and then a clerk at the Claremont Hotel claims that the girls checked into the hotel on December 30th. All of this just sounds very unlikely to actually be the specific girls we're looking for because they didn't have any money.
Yeah.
To do all of this stuff. Unless they were like hiding money over time and were actually running away that night.
On January 3rd, three separate employees at a department store in Englewood said that the girls were in the store listening to Elvis Presley records. And this one's kind of weird. A woman in Nashville named Pearl Neville claims that she met the girls in a bathroom on January 17th. And then she went with them to a state employment agency to help them search for work. And then a clerk at this agency identified the sisters from photographs and claimed that they used the surname Grimes in the applications that they filled out.
I'd be interested to like see the actual application, though.
Right. In the early hours of January 14th, the parents of a classmate of Patricia's named Sandra Tolston received two separate anonymous phone calls. During the first call, no one on the other end of the line spoke. 15 minutes later, the phone rang again, and Sandra's mother, Anne, heard a frightened and depressed girl asking, "Is that you, Sandra? Is Sandra there?" Before Anne could get Sandra on the phone, the caller hung up, and Anne informed the police that she believed the caller to be Patricia Grimes. After the January 19th television and radio appearances by Elvis, an anonymous letter was sent to the Chicago Sun-Times written by a girl who had been with another girl named Betty the night the girls disappeared and said that she had seen them. She wrote, quote, "Outside the show, we all got to talking, and we exchanged phone numbers. When we got off the street where we turned off, we said goodbye, and we ran across the street. Then, Betty forgot something she had to tell Barbara, and we ran back to the corner. A man about 22 or 25 was talking to them. He pushed Barbara in the back seat of the car and Pat in the front seat. We got part of the license plate number as the car drove by us. The first four numbers were 2184. Betty thinks there were three or four numbers after that. When we heard that they were missing, we didn't know what to do.
Interesting.
And again, these are just some of the sightings.
Yeah, that was a small sample, and that was already long as hell.
Right?
So, on January 22nd, 1957, the girls are finally found 25 days after they had disappeared. After a recent snowfall, the ground began to thaw, and a construction worker named Leonard Prescott spotted what he later described as being these flesh-colored things behind a guardrail as he drove along a rural county road.
I always, every time I read stuff, I forgot that it was, December, January in Chicago.
Yeah, so it's freezing. Mm-hmm. Initially, he thought they may be mannequins, but he later returned to the site with his wife, Marie, because he couldn't stop thinking about it. She fainted upon taking a closer look, as the two had discovered two nude frozen bodies that would later be found to be the Grimes sisters. The couple immediately reported their findings to the Willow Springs Police Department. The girls had been laid out in a horizontal section of snow-covered ground directly behind the guardrail, which extended for just about 10 feet before an incline on German Church Road. And Barbara was laying on her left side with her legs drawn slightly up towards her torso, and there were three wounds in her chest resembling ice pick wounds, and then also had blunt force trauma on her face and head. And her sister Patricia lay on her back with her body covering her sister's head and her own head turned sharply to the right. Her face and body were also covered in bruises. It is believed the girls were driven to this location and that their bodies had been dragged or lifted out of the vehicle, then placed or thrown behind the guardrail. Joseph, this is just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
The girl's father was driven to the crime scene to identify the bodies. He identified them as being his daughters, but, can you imagine having to see your daughters in that state?
Yeah, because normally they, take them back to the morgue and kind of clean them up before they do identification.
I wonder if that was, something that was instituted later because of things like this, maybe. It being too hard. I don't know.
So or maybe
looking into it.
Yeah, or maybe because it was such a big case, they wanted to get them identified right away.
Maybe.
Or something.
Yeah. Over 160 police immediately began doing a search of the crime scene and got additional help from the forest preserves. Unfortunately, their search uncovered little to no physical evidence, and later the search itself would actually be severely criticized due to those organizing the search allowing untrained individuals to trample over any evidence which may have been there. Because when you have that many people on a crime scene, you're going to ruin evidence. After the girls were found dead, the media told salacious stories about their final hours, not based in any fact.
The autopsies on the girls were performed the next day by three experienced forensic pathologists. And they actually had to wait until the girls' bodies thawed in order to perform the autopsies.
Yeah.
They did a five-hour examination on each girl. And even with that, they were unable to reach agreement on either a date or cause of death. They did agree that based on the stomach contents, the girls' dinner from the night that they went missing was still in there, which means that they most likely died within 5 hours of the time that they had last been seen. This made their most likely time of death either late December 28th or early December 29th.
So it wasn't a huge difference that they couldn't agree on, but they couldn't agree which day it actually happened.
The cause of death was ruled as being a combination of shock and exposure. They also concluded that many of the wounds on the girls' bodies had been done so after death by rodents. There were no obvious fatal wounds on either girl, and their toxicology reports showed that neither had been drunk, drugged, or poisoned prior to death.
But, like, one of them had ice pick marks in their chest.
I read something that said that some of them disagreed that it could have been, like, rats
burrowing. Oh, mm-hmm. That's horrible. Okay. I'm sorry I asked. That was very sad.
So none of their clothing was also ever found, but both girls' bodies were relatively clean for being out in the elements, which is really weird.
Yeah, like they either immediately were just covered with snow and frozen or like somehow, because they were just clean out in the woods.
A month later.
Yeah.
It was found that Barbara had likely had intercourse before she died, but it's unknown if it was consensual or not, as they could not find any signs of forced activity. The official death certificates listed the cause of death as murder and was specifically listed as being secondary shock. This was a result of exposure to low temperatures.
So, like, they were on their way to being dead and then died from the cold, essentially.
Basically, the girls' bodies were preserved very well because they were frozen and then hidden under a layer of snow for a few weeks.
So they were almost, like, encased.
Yeah, like they weren't decomposing yet.
Yeah, they were preserved.
Despite these official conclusions, the chief investigator for the Cook County's coroner's office disagreed with the official time of death, later telling the media that there had been numerous marks of violence on those girls' faces, strongly indicative of their being the recipients of violence as opposed to post-mortem rodent infestation. That was a sentence for me, apparently. He also said that the layer of ice on the girls didn't match up with the time the freezing temperatures came.
And this annoyed me because I didn't really understand why he was trying to argue that they died at a later date, because they still had their dinner from that night in their stomachs. So to me, that does suggest they had to have died relatively quickly for their food to not be digested, you know?
I mean, 100%, but it's like the murderer could have fed them the same thing. You know, like people don't think like that.
Yeah.
But apparently this guy does.
I guess. That's like a very conspiracy theory way to look at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think they probably did have violence that wasn't just rodent infestations, like he says, but kind of feels like it happened right away. Because that's typical of these cases. You don't usually keep them alive for hours after they're abducted. They're usually dead pretty soon.
And an argument that he also had was that he stated that there was semen discovered from Patricia and that Barbara had curdled milk in her stomach, even though she didn't have milk with her dinner, and her friend said that she didn't have milk at the movie theater.
Which is weird. That's like the weirdest thing in the case to me. Yeah. Is where did the milk come from? After their death, their mother made a statement saying, "My poor babies, why couldn't they have taken me and let my babies live? If the police had listened to me, they would have had a true story half an hour after the girls were missing." Which she's not wrong.
Yeah.
A funeral mass was held for the girls at St. Maurice Church, where Patricia had attended grade school. And this occurred on January 28th, 1957. The funeral expenses were donated by the Walschlinger Funeral Home, and the funeral was attended by many people in the town, including the mayor. And the girls' schoolmates actually acted as the pallbearers during the service. And newspapers reported that Loretta was inconsolable, collapsing multiple times and loudly sobbing when she was reunited with her daughters. There were also lots of members of the press at the funeral, and they were very disruptive and showed no respect for the grieving family. And many family members resented the media after this. And, like, I would, too. Don't be a dick at a funeral.
Yeah, I feel like the media, even though it was such a big case, shouldn't have been allowed inside of the funeral.
Yeah, that just is too disruptive. The girls were buried in two white coffins in the Holy Shelfer. That's not it. Sulphur Cemetery in Worth, Illinois, next to their sister, Liana Freck, who had died 2 years earlier from an unknown illness, which is so sad now that mom has lost three daughters. Mm-hmm. Rosemary Chodor, a friend of one of the Grimes children, said of the girls, "They were nice, ordinary little girls. Poor and happy, we all were. Their mother had to work, and she assigned them housework like mopping the floors. Our idea of fun was to pour soapy water over them and slide around in our bare feet, giggling silly, little kid stuff, you know? They might have accepted a ride with someone they knew to get warm, either that or someone forced them into a car." During the disappearance, Loretta was unable to work, so friends, neighbors, classmates, and the press organized different ways to raise money for the family, eventually raising enough to pay the remaining mortgage on the family home and to bury Barbara and Patricia's bodies, which is really nice.
It is.
In May of 1957, Loretta Grimes got an anonymous phone call from a man who claimed to have undressed and killed her daughters. The Grimes had gotten many hoax phone calls after the girls had disappeared, but this man ended his phone call with information indicating that he may have indeed been the perpetrator by saying, "I know something about your little girl that no one else knows, not even the police. The smallest girl's toes were crossed at the feet."
Now we're going to go into the suspects. And over the course of the investigation, there were three men who stood out as primary suspects. The first was Edward Lee, who they called Benny Bedwell. He was a 21-year-old drifter who was originally from Tennessee. He had been evicted from his family's home in East Garfield Park in November of 1956. In the weeks leading up to the sisters' murder, he occasionally earned money working as a part-time dishwasher in a restaurant on Skid Row in Chicago. Bedwell was described as being tall and looking pretty similar to Elvis Presley. According to the owners of the restaurant he worked at, John and Minnie Duros, said he and another young male had been at their business with two girls who looked like the Grimes sisters in the early morning of December 30th.
Did you happen to look up a photo of him?
Yes.
Because he does look like Elvis.
Yeah.
It's weird.
So the restaurant owners gave this information to the police on the 24th of January. Benny Bedwell was arrested shortly after and was interrogated about the matter for 3 days straight. Originally, he insisted that the owners were mistaken in their identification of the girls, but then signed a 14-page confession in which he claimed that him and a 28-year-old friend named William Willingham,
which is the greatest name ever,
that is, that him and William Willingham had hung out with the girls on December 30th and spent time with them until January 7th, typically spending their time drinking in various establishments on Skid Row. Honestly, who is... I know it's the 50s, but who's going to serve a 12-year-old girl?
I don't know, because she looks young, too.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, I know Skid Row is a real place, but all I can think of is the song from Little Shop of Horrors. It's like, down on Skid Row. Yeah. And that's all I want to sing, and it's really distracting me.
So he also said, after spending several days together, they went out and got some hot dogs. Then the boys made sexual advances at the girls. Keep in mind, they were 21 and 28, and the girls were 12 and 15. And the girls said no, so they extensively beat both girls and then threw their nude bodies into a snow-filled ditch. This confession led to his arrest on January 27th, 1957. After reading the confession, Loretta said, "It's a lie. My girls wouldn't be on West Madison Street. They didn't even know where it was." The other man, William Willingham, admitted that he had been in the company of Bedwell and two other girls, but denied that they were the Grimes sisters, and he also denied any involvement in the murders.
Hopefully you weren't hanging out with a 12 and 15-year-old girl at 28.
Right? Later, Bedwell would recant his confession, saying that it was only provided after being held in custody for 4 days in the belief that the police would release him if he confessed. The autopsy also supported his recantation because there was no alcohol or hot dogs in the girls' systems, and the girls had not been beaten to death. Bedwell had also clocked in at his work at 4:19 p.m. on December 28th, and he was clocked in through 12:30 a.m. on December 29th, covering the time that the girls were most likely abducted.
Yeah, so his story checks out.
Yeah. He was eventually freed on a $20,000 bond paid for by an individual from Champaign. The same year of his acquittal, he would also be tried and acquitted of a rape of a 13-year-old girl in Oak Hill, Florida.
So, you win some and you lose some.
Right.
And in his case, he really won both.
He did.
Because he got acquitted.
But, I mean, not a great person.
Yeah, he's still not a great guy whether or not he killed them.
Right.
So, the next suspect is Max Fleeg, who was a 17-year-old boy, initially considered to be, like, one of the prime suspects in the case. And it was mostly because of his age, honestly.
Yeah.
But because of his age, he was protected by a law which prevented juveniles from taking polygraphs. Despite this, Chicago police captain Ralph Pettigrew, sure.
Yeah.
Persuaded him to take an unofficial polygraph test, and he did take it. During the polygraph, he allegedly confessed to the murders. But with no legal means of using this test as evidence, police were forced to release him without a charge. That's like, don't look at the more expensive thing if you can't buy the more expensive thing. You right? know, like, don't do the polygraph if you can't use the polygraph. They also had a lack of physical evidence tying him to the murders. And later, he was jailed for the murder of a young woman unrelated to the Grimes sisters. So, all in all, also not a super great guy.
Yeah. The next one is my favorite. His name is Walter Krantz, and he was a 53-year-old steam fitter and self-proclaimed psychic. On January 15th, he called the switchboard operator at Chicago Central Police Station complaint room to inform the operator of his conviction and that both sisters were dead and that their bodies could be found in an unincorporated area of Lyons Township. So, like, I feel like the operator just automatically freaked out when she heard this, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But he refused to give his name to the operator, telling her he experienced this revelation in a dream, and then he hung up.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for Walter Krantz, the operator was able to trace the call to a location close to his home. The park that was described by him on the call was actually 1 mile away from the true location where the girls' bodies would be found 1 week later.
So, like, a weird coincidence.
Yeah. Police brought him in for questioning, and he informed them that several members of his family and ancestors possessed psychic powers and that he experienced that vision after an evening of heavy drinking.
Same when I experience visions.
Right? Police were like, this is our number one guy.
Yeah.
And a handwriting expert even thought that a ransom note received by the girl's mother prior to them being found could have been written by him. Despite all of this, he still denied any involvement in the crime, and after several interrogations, he was released.
Yeah, they couldn't, like, pin him down on anything substantial.
Exactly.
And after that, that's pretty much the last that we heard about this case until 2013.
Yeah, so when, a good, what, 55, 60 years later?
Yeah. In 2013, a retired West Chicago police officer named Raymond Johnson began investigating this case on his own. And he is considered by many to be an expert on this case after he became interested in it in 2010. He was researching for a book that he was writing about the city's history and then like stumbled upon this case and became super interested in it and like dedicated his research to that.
Makes sense.
Yeah. James Grimes, who is the girl's younger brother, who was 11 years old at the time of the murders, said in 2012 that he welcomed what he saw as a public reopening of the case, stating, "I just assumed it was never going to be solved, but maybe there's hope." After researching this case extensively, Raymond stated that the case is still a solvable one, but only with public assistance. After he began researching, a woman contacted him to report that she was with the sisters the night they vanished, but was too afraid to tell the police all this time. But to me, this kind of feels unreliable because I was reading articles and he doesn't follow up with this person at all and doesn't like say anything further about this.
Yeah.
And he believes the perpetrator of the crime had been a 23-year-old self-confessed child killer named Charles Leroy Melquist. And he had been considered a suspect in the case originally, but it gets a little messy. So in September of 1958, he was convicted of the murder of a 15-year-old girl named Bonnie Lay Scott. And this was a girl that he had known before she was murdered. She had been found 2 months after her disappearance, nude and decapitated. And this was less than 10 miles from where the Grimes sisters' bodies had been discovered. Following this discovery, police noted similarities in the body disposal in both cases, like being all nude and some other things. Obviously, this one's a little more extreme because it involves a decapitation. But despite this, Melquist was never questioned about the Grimes murders, as his attorney had forbidden him from being questioned in regards to this case. Melquist served 11 years of his 99-year sentence for the murder of Bonnie Lay Scott and later married and had 2 children.
So, you know, he just went on and lived his life.
Just chilling. The day after Bonnie was discovered, Loretta Grimes received a phone call from someone who claimed responsibility for her murder. They said, "I've committed another perfect crime. This is another one those cops won't solve, and they're not going to blame Bedwell or Barry Cook." And Loretta would remain adamant until she passed away that this caller was the same one who called about her daughter's feet, saying, "I will never forget that voice." And with all of that being said, Melquist did pass away in 2010, and he was never questioned about a possible involvement in this crime. So it is alleged that he did it. We can't say that he did.
Exactly.
And there was also another murder similar to the Grimes sisters. 2 brothers and their friends had been murdered just miles away. Just like the sisters, the boys had gone out to see a movie and never returned. Their bodies had also been stripped and dumped on the side of the road and obviously beaten.
And I forgot to write that their case was also not solved.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's sad. Later in life, Loretta Grimes volunteered at a nearby prison and secured a promise for the police that they would never stop looking for her daughter's killer. In 1989, at the age of 83, Loretta died without ever getting an answer. And officially, this case is still open and remains unsolved and is known as the murder that caused Chicago to lose its innocence. And there's also a Facebook group called Help Solve Chicago's Grimes Sisters Murder that has around 1,780 members today. But if you think you do have any information in that case, go ahead and report it.
Yeah, or like your grandparents lived in Chicago in the 50s.
Yeah, ask them about that case.
Do you have any opinions on who you think it would be?
I don't think it was any of those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it might have been the guy who murdered the other girl.
It might be him. Like, he does have a more compelling story. But it kind of feels like one of those things where, like the friend said, why would the girls get in a car with someone they didn't know unless they were forced into the car?
Yeah.
And that can totally happen, but I think it's a lot harder to lure two girls into a car than it is to lure just one.
Yeah, I definitely think there had to have been more than one perpetrator.
Really? I just think there had to be, like, they knew the girls.
That could work, too. Or they had, like, a weapon or something.
But it also kind of sounds like there was a child murderer at this time.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if they ever looked into Melquist's connection to those boys' deaths as well.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't see anything about it. And you know, I couldn't find the names of the boys to even do more research on my own.
That stinks. I hate when you, like, find something and you can't, like...
You're like, this could be gold.
Yeah, you're like, I can't spend too much time on this specific thing right now, but I want to. Yeah. That would be interesting because he was a self-confessed child killer, so I don't really know what that means. Like, I don't know if... During his confession for Bonnie, he said he killed more children.
Yeah.
I, like, looked at his story briefly, but not extensively. But, yeah, that's another unsolved case.
I hate the unsolved ones.
I know. It's just, like, you want to know an answer, but life sucks and you don't get an answer sometimes.
I know.
But do you want to go ahead and give us a Florida man today?
I'm actually going to give you a Florida woman.
Okay.
So this happened Thursday the 9th, so a couple days before Easter. And it comes from Fox News in Tampa. And it says, Florida woman stuffed plastic Easter eggs with porn and placed them in strangers' mailboxes.
Doing the Lord's work this fine Easter. Right.
Oh, maybe it wasn't from Tampa. But just the Tampa news station reported.
Right.
So for several days, deputies in one Florida county were receiving phone calls complaining about Easter eggs filled with pornographic images being placed in residents' mailboxes. Later, they found the suspect. On Wednesday, Flagler County deputies said that they received calls about a woman placing more of the plastic eggs in mailboxes on Hernandez Avenue, and had identified the suspect's vehicle, a Honda Civic. Officials say that the eggs contained pornographic images, non-threatening references to nearby churches and county buildings, and other items.
It's like so porn in one, and another one's like, go to my church!
Yeah. By 11:19 p.m., deputies located the vehicle heading north and made a traffic stop. Inside the Honda Civic was 42-year-old April Sestoni.
Oh, no.
42. Detectives said Sestoni admitted to placing the items in the mailbox, saying she was educating people. And a bag of pornographic material was found inside the vehicle. She said that she had distributed over 400 pamphlets within the past few days. And the deputies said that she displayed no symptoms of COVID-19. They thought she was just, like, feverish. Basically, the sheriff said their team did a great job. Shit like that.
Yeah.
Apparently, she worked for Publix.
Nice.
And she faces charges of distributing obscene material and driving with a suspended license.
I mean, that one, yeah. I feel like she was just trying to find her own thing to do during quarantine. And
honestly,
should we, like, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Should we put her in jail for that?
But it's also a felony to put stuff in people's mailboxes.
Yeah, that's true. But it's a fun little Easter egg. You get fucking free porn in it.
I know, right? Like, yeah, I'd be mad if my kid opened the mail. But if I opened the mail, I'd be like,
yeah.
Okay.
Also, just because I feel like this really is evident now more than ever. I read this online the other day and it really stuck out to me.
All right.
What's classy when you're rich, but trashy when you're poor?
What?
Florida. I was like, if that ain't true.
That is the funniest
thing. Is that not the most accurate thing?
Wow.
All right, guys, we hope that we could keep you some company during this time, but make sure that you go and check us out on all of our social medias at Crime Binge. Just look for our logo and you'll find us.
Yeah, and please, please rate and review on Apple iTunes. It only takes a couple seconds. Just be like, hi, as your review, and I'll be stoked.
Yeah. And... Keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.